from WNYC Studios. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Friday, March 15th. I want to start today by playing a few clips from Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's Israel-Palestine speech on the Senate floor yesterday that are not the simple soundbite you've probably been hearing in the newscasts about Benjamin Netanyahu. And then we'll have a conversation with two guests about how to get to yes on some kind of ceasefire. Israel and Hamas are stuck in those negotiations, as you probably know, and reports are that scores of civilians or more are still being killed every day, as well as the fact that the Israeli hostages continue to be held. So there's tremendous urgency from a humanitarian standpoint, but like with any ceasefire, it will take both warring parties to agree. But first to these speech excerpts from Schumer. We have the luxury of time on this show, unlike the news programs with a tighter clock, so we'll stretch out just a little bit beyond what they can do. What you probably have heard that I won't bother to replay is that Schumer called Prime Minister Netanyahu an obstacle to peace and a two-state solution, along with Hamas, Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas, and radical right Israelis. He mentioned all four of those. You've probably heard that Schumer called for new elections in Israel once the war in Gaza starts to wind down, and accused Netanyahu of being too willing to tolerate the civilian death toll in Gaza and of pushing Israel toward the status of a pariah state. Schumer used that term, pariah. That's the part you probably know. And that by itself is a very big deal. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz, for example, called the speech a watershed moment in Israel-U.S. relations. Fred Kaplan, who writes about the Middle East for Slate, had an article with the headline that the speech seems like a turning point. But here are a few more Schumer excerpts. Number one, right at the beginning of the speech, Schumer identified himself as the highest-ranking Jewish elected official in United States history and claimed that he was not speaking just for himself.
I speak for myself, but I also speak for so many mainstream Jewish Americans, a silent majority whose nuanced views on the matter have never been well represented in this country's discussions about the war in Gaza.
So Schumer believes these are the views, his are the views, of what he calls a silent majority of mainstream Jewish Americans. He may have started new conversations at many Jewish American family dinner tables, those who aren't already talking about Netanyahu's fitness to remain in charge or not. We'll see, I guess, over these coming nights. Next clip. As much as he singled out Netanyahu by name on the Israeli side, and everybody knows who Netanyahu is, Schumer also singled out two of Netanyahu's cabinet ministers who Schumer identified as leading right-wing radicals who need to be denounced by name. Obviously, people who are not as much household names in the United States. Let's listen.
The worst example of this radicalism are Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich and Ministry of National Security Itamar Ben-Gavir. Minister Smotrich has in the past openly called for the subjugation and forced displacement of all Palestinians in the West Bank. In the current crisis, he has used inflammatory rhetoric and called for punitive restrictions on Palestinian farmers in the West Bank during the olive harvest. He has prevented the transfer of funds to the Palestinian Authority, and he has opposed the provision of any humanitarian assistance to Gaza, going so far as to stop agreed-upon shipments of flour. Minister Ben-Gavir is no better. When he was a young man, he was barred from the Israeli military service for his extremist views. Last year, in a move only intended to antagonize the Muslim population, he visited the Temple Mount with his supporters as a brazen show of force towards Palestinians. And during this current conflict, he has facilitated the mass distribution of guns to far-right settlers, exacerbating instability, fueling violence. There's a nastiness to what Ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gavir believe and how they use their positions of authority and influence, an eagerness to inflame and provoke, that is profoundly irresponsible and self-destructive.
Again, Chuck Schumer from his Senate floor speech on those two especially radical right-wing government ministers in Israel as he sees it. And in fact, one of the reasons Schumer called for new elections and declared Netanyahu an obstacle to peace and a two-state solution is his refusal to call out those ministers.
He won't disavow ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gavir in their calls for Israelis to drive Palestinians out of Gaza and the West Bank. He won't commit to a military operation in Rafah that prioritizes protecting civilian life. He won't engage responsibly in discussions about a day after plan for Gaza and a longer term pathway to peace.
Now, some of you may wonder this about Schumer's speech. Even if it broke new ground rhetorically, is it just words? Biden is getting that criticism a lot recently. So why doesn't Schumer just sign on to the resolution from another Jewish senator, Bernie Sanders, that would invoke the U.S. Foreign Assistance Act, which prohibits security assistance to any government, quote, which engages in a consistent pattern of gross violations of internationally recognized human rights. That quote is from the law, the U.S. Foreign Assistance Act. Schumer did not go that far yesterday, but he did suggest that the time may be coming when he might.
If Prime Minister Netanyahu's current coalition remains in power after the war begins to wind down and continues to pursue dangerous and inflammatory policies that test existing U.S. standards for assistance, then the United States will have no choice but to play a more active role in shaping Israeli policy by using our leverage to change the present course.
So there are some excerpts, folks, from the Schumer floor speech. Excerpts that you may not have heard for a closer look, as we can do here on our long-form show. In a minute, we'll play one more clip from the speech about what kind of ceasefire Schumer supports or doesn't support, because as it happens, even before Schumer's speech, we were planning to have a conversation today in this segment with two guests about how to get to yes on some kind of ceasefire. As I mentioned earlier, Israel and Hamas are stuck in those negotiations, even as reports are that scores of civilians or more are still being killed every day, as well as the fact that the Israeli hostages continue to be held. So there is tremendous urgency from a humanitarian standpoint, but like with any ceasefire, it will take both warring parties to agree. We're hoping now to not have a debate, but a kind of solutions workshop, if you will, on how to get the situation unstuck. As we try to do often on the show, we hope to get beyond the usual debate over which side is worse to other substantive questions and maybe even answers. Let me introduce our guests. Khaled El-Gindi, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, where he also directs their program on Palestine and Israeli-Palestinian affairs. He is author of the book Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump, published by the Brookings Institution Press. He previously served as a fellow in the foreign policy program at Brookings for 8 years and was an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations of 2007 and 2008. El-Gindi is also an adjunct instructor in Arab studies at Georgetown University. And also with us, John Alterman, who directs the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He also teaches at Johns Hopkins and George Washington Universities and was previously a special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, and from 2009 to 2019, a member of the Chief of Naval Operations Executive Panel. So thank you very much for joining us today. Welcome both of you to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Before we discuss these fire scenarios specifically, I'm curious to hear each of your basic reactions to Senate Majority Leader Schumer's speech and how much you each think it is some kind of watershed moment, as Haaretz put it, and whether it can have any actual impact on anything in the short or long term. Khaled El-Gindi, will you go first?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think Senator Schumer's speech was probably came as a shock to many Israelis. I don't think anyone expected that sort of rhetoric and tone coming from someone like Schumer, whose pro-Israel bona fides are really, I think, unquestioned. And so I think it really it does send a signal of enormous frustration in Washington with the Israeli leadership and with Israeli actions, including its conduct in the war. And I think it's also represents, a seismic shift in American domestic politics, where in particular the Democratic Party has shifted very, very far on this issue. So I think it's also an acknowledgement to, you know, as a Democratic majority leader in the Senate, that his own party has changed and that American policy will eventually have to change as well. The problem is that there's a little bit of dissonance there, because Senator Schumer talks about the dangerous and inflammatory policies pursued by the Netanyahu government, but these are the very same policies that have been sustained by the Biden administration for almost 6 months now. So there are some kinks that need to be worked out, but it is, I think, an important shift.
And John Alterman, your reaction to the Schumer speech?
You know, as Khaled said, Chuck Schumer's bona fides on Israel are impressive, but he took the time at the beginning of his speech to lay them out. He talked about his affection, his connection to Israel. He talked about how his name Schumer comes from the Hebrew word shomer, to guard. He feels himself to be a guardian of Israel. The whole first part of the speech was establishing his legitimacy as what I think a lot of people in the Jewish community call lover of Zion, to say where Israel is going is incredibly damaging to Israel's interests, the interests of the community that supports Israel. The other piece I think that I just want to respond to that Khaled was talking about, where the Democratic Party has shifted on Israel. You know, it used to be in the 1950s and 60s that Israel is a Democratic issue, not a Republican issue. In the 1970s, it became more of a bipartisan issue. Since the 1990s, Israel has become increasingly a Republican issue. Sometimes when I've been to AIPAC events, I sit at tables where overwhelmingly the participants at the table are not Northeast American Jews, but evangelical Christians from the Midwest. This is something that Benjamin Netanyahu pioneered as a strategy for U.S.-Israeli relations. Starting in the 90s, he felt it was a way to ensure that Israel remained a bipartisan issue by really bringing some hardline Republicans along to support Israel. And what we've seen over the last 25 years is as more and more of those evangelical Christians have become more supportive of more conservative or more right-wing Israeli governments, we're seeing significant attrition in parts of the Democratic Party, saying this isn't what we ever signed up for.
Largely because of Netanyahu and continued settlement in the West Bank and things like that, yes?
Netanyahu, I think, is often misunderstood as a right-wing leader. I think Netanyahu is a centrist Israeli leader. He has a superb sense for where the center of Israeli politics is, and that's largely where he's been. I think what happened after the last election, he had to bring on extreme right-wing figures who would have been unthinkable to be included in a party before, but he couldn't form a coalition either way. That's driven him, so he's now at the left of his party, whereas traditionally Netanyahu, for most of his 16 years of prime minister, has been really in the middle.
So, Khaled, I think John is saying there that Netanyahu, as much as he's seen as a radical in this country, represents a fairly mainstream Israeli public opinion. And I have seen some early reaction coming from Israel to Schumer's speech that even among people who oppose Netanyahu in Israel and even oppose him from his left, they're a little bit like, stay out of our domestic affairs. Some of them are, some of them aren't. But I wonder, given that and given what John was just saying, how much impact do you think the Schumer speech has on anything except American politics?
No, I mean, I think it will influence Israeli politics, at least the debate for a couple days, perhaps longer. The question of where Netanyahu sits on the political spectrum is a relative one, because Israeli politics overall have shifted very dramatically to the right over the past, you know, couple decades. And I think that was especially true in the last election, in which these far, far right extremists were brought into the coalition. You know, people who were beyond the pale, you know, maybe 20 years ago are now front and center policymakers and power brokers. And I think that's a reflection of the Israeli electorate. The Israeli public has moved to the right. The Israeli Labor Party is a shell of its former self. I mean, it barely exists. There isn't much left of the Israeli left. So Netanyahu, of course, being the, you know, quintessential political opportunist, he has lurched to the right to kind of, he's tracking the trends in Israeli politics. And of course, he needed a far-right coalition just to be in power. But there is something deeper going on than just the person of Netanyahu. And I think that's where there's a little bit of, I think, where some of the dissonance comes from, is this problem isn't with the person of Netanyahu. Yes, he's highly problematic. But there's broad public and political support for just about everything Netanyahu is doing, certainly in Gaza, but even to an extent in the West Bank. There is not a lot of opposition to the occupation, to the settlements, and so forth. To the extent there is an Israeli opposition, it is about domestic issues like, you know, the role of the Orthodox in the military, or the judicial reforms, you know, the mm-hmm. overhaul that Netanyahu was seeking, that would kind of reorganize, you know, and threaten even Israeli transparency and democracy. So the occupation, I think, doesn't animate Israeli politics the way it might have in the past.
You know, some early reaction coming in. Oh, John, go ahead. You want to keep it going? Go ahead.
One of the interesting things I would encourage listeners to do is, you know, with modern web browsers, you can automatically translate foreign newspapers. And if you look at the domestic Israeli press, that is not the Haaretz English edition, the Jerusalem Post, the Times of Israel, which are directed toward international audiences. If you look at what Israelis are reading in Yediot Ahronot, Ma'ariv, you see a systematic lack of interest in conditions in Gaza, humanitarian suffering, the Israeli strategy in the war. It's about Israeli victimhood. It's about soldiers who fell on the battlefield. It's about displaced communities in Israel. You know, I think in many ways we are reacting to a set of realities in Gaza that Israelis aren't, because that's not what the Israeli press has. And to me, it's not so surprising that Israeli politics are where they are, because the Israeli information space in Hebrew, which, as I say, everybody can look at, is really not focused on Palestinians at all. It's still immersed every day, as people say, every day is October 8th. It's still immersed in Israeli suffering, Israeli vulnerability. The Israeli need to protect Israelis.
And as I often say at the end of these segments, we won't solve the Middle East today, but maybe we'll call this one an Israeli-Palestine Solutions Workshop, and we'll do more like this. We thank Khaled El-Gindi, Senior Fellow at the Middle East Institute, where he also directs their program on Palestine and Israeli-Palestinian Affairs, and John Alterman, who directs the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks a lot.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.